dropped dead for 14 years. That is to say, the problem of Jews in the face of the dissolution of the forces of liberalism and enlightenment, which had led to emancipation in the first place. In this problem of Jews in the face of the dissolution of liberalism and enlightenment, the role of the Jewish establishment should be clear by now, and also the role of the majority, who still continued to cling to these ideas. But a younger generation, which came to maturity in the 70s and 80s, were influenced by the same kind of things which influenced the entire European younger generation in the 70s and 80s, namely the opposition to liberalism and the Enlightenment. That younger generation, influenced by what influenced, as I said, all the younger generations, tried to overcome the problem in several ways. Before Easter, we discussed the more complete assimilation to the national mystique, and we must now come to the attraction of socialism. The attraction itself for young Jews of this and subsequent generations is not very difficult to analyze. The class struggle made everyone equal who fought on the side of the proletariat, that is, on the side of the coming class, and the end result, the inevitable victory, would fuse the individual with a true community, that community of all of humanity, and not merely the community of the nation as such. But matters were not quite that simple. In the West, Jews were not working class. And those who were affected, therefore, by the new anti-liberalism and the revolt of youth of the 70s and 80s were, by and large, young intellectuals, as was the case generally, and not just for Jews, but in this case, mostly Jewish intellectuals. There are exceptions. Some of them who went into socialism and indeed founded socialist parties worked within those parties, especially in Austrian Marxism, as this is pronounced. After all, Victor Adler was the founder of Austrian Marxism. But still, the real problem was not those Jews who integrated themselves into the socialist party, but those Jews who came to socialism as young intellectuals. The problems which they presented were, as a matter of fact, realized to a very great extent. There is a very interesting document about that, which will warm some of your hearts. The communist speaker, that is, the head of the Communist Speakers Bureau in Germany in the 1930s, Hans Jäger, reports that in one meeting in a working class district in Berlin, in 1930, a simple worker asked the following question: what are intellectuals? Is it the same as being a Jew? This kind of idea, it was in the working class, that the intellectual is the same as being a Jew, comes from the problem that especially the young Jewish intellectuals from the 1880s on are presented within the socialism. For there is no doubt that they introduced a new element into socialism, which was to be of great concern to the socialist movement and to themselves. Indeed, I think it would be correct to speak of a particular Jewish intellectual socialism, which became prominent and indeed problematic within the socialist party. The man who was a British influence for this socialist was Hermann Kohl, a man about whom you read in your Bergman reading. Hermann Kohl and the so-called revival of Kantian philosophy played an important part. And when you come to read the chapter on Korah in your Bergman reading, you must read it also from this point of view. For what Cohen revived was a philosophical socialism which derives from Kant, but which is intimately fused with the tradition of ethical monotheism, that is, the tradition of Reformed Judaism, of ethical monotheism, which I talked about at some length earlier on. It is intimately fused with that. As a matter of fact, for Cohen, at this stage of his life, God is in fact the categorical imperative, which must lead to a moral and just social order. To be sure, the messianic elements, which Hugo Bergman, in your reading, underlines, were undoubtedly there. But I would not underline the messianic elements of Cohen to this extent. I think it is more important that he found that Kant's categorical imperative and ethical monotheism did indeed coincide, and that this coinciding meant, in fact, a truer community of men. It must result, for example, he believed, in the abolition of the division of labor. It must lead to a whole personality. It must lead, in other words, as Kant had thought it could lead, to the ethical and moral state. Kant's influence on that generation of young Jews cannot be underestimated. The influence became even greater when Lenin denounced him, indeed wrote a rather silly pamphlet, one of Lenin's most silly writings, called Materialism and Imperial Criticism. Lenin attacked him in a pamphlet, Materialism and Imperial Criticism, attacked him for bringing idealism into socialism, but above all, for bringing abstractions into socialism. His influence to this generation came above all to a man who was to spread it and to deepen it. It came through his young friend, Kurt Eisner. Kurt Eisner, who acknowledged Cohen as his teacher, though Cohen, as you will see later, diverged and became indeed a German nationalist of sorts. Kurt Eisner, known to history as the leader of the Bavarian Revolution of 1918, popularized this in an essay on Kant, called Marx and Kant, in fact, in 1904. And the idea of which he put forward, and which became central to this intellectual socialism, is that Kant's ethic provides the living content of human action. The living content which fills the flow of human action within history. Now, to be sure, Eisner and the others acknowledge the Marxist historical dialectic. But the historical dialectic was the way history worked, to be sure. But the content and the standard of this dialect was indeed Kantian ethics. What it meant in practice is also clear. It meant a rejection of force, a rejection of tactics. It meant, in effect, a playing down of the struggle, of the class struggle. It meant, in effect, a denial of the scientific revolution in the Marxist sense. We are back, in a sense, with the categorical imperative. These young Jews, without being conscious of it, were repeating the great ideal that had underlain emancipation. For Kurt Eisner, the ethic stands above the flow of history, which must measure itself by it. Because of these ideas, he was fired as editor of the former the Social Democratic paper. Rational cognition must come first. rational cognition, the categorical imperative. The class struggle was obviously secondary. The ethic was first. Bettering of economic conditions is not enough. And Max Adler, another one of these young Jewish intellectuals, said an action must be judged whether it is ethically right, not whether it is proletarian or not. Because an ethically right action is by definition also an action in favor of the proletariat. A very kind of significant statement. Tactics, therefore, always mean force and power, revolutionary tactics. Eisner put it this way, only the spiritual struggle is part of humanity, all else is bestial. Our religion, and Eisner uses this word, is a belief in the future, which will mean the possibility of the unfolding of all man's possibilities. Our eternal life is what everyone does in the service of humanity. When Eisner started the Bavarian Revolution, his first speech that he made as the new revolutionary leader in Bavaria in 1918, he said as follows, "We are no longer powerless. We have won control over our own destiny." Now you can contrast that with Lenin. Lenin would never have said that because it runs directly counter to any dictatorship of the proletariat. We have now won control over our own destiny. That was his first reaction as a revolutionary leader. His means to fulfill the revolution are very similarly slanted. He too believed in a council of workers and peasants. But his council of workers and peasants would not be a dictatorship of the proletariat. They would not rule, because as he said, all rule makes for stupidity, because it means the exercise of power, and power means, in fact, stupidity. Instead, the Soviet of workers and peasants would educate workers and peasants, would educate how to manage their own destiny. And therefore he believed that they must exist side by side with Parliament, side by side with Parliament, and only slowly replace Parliament. Replace Parliament only slowly and only when they have educated themselves to take over their own destiny. His slogan was, half the power to the Soviets. It was a definitely anti-Leninist slogan. Half the power to the Soviets. Because the whole power meant stupidity. Because it meant rule, it meant force, it meant dictatorship. And it was meant to be education in self-government. Now Eisner was murdered before he could put all this into practice. But it explains a thrust which you have in Austria also, with Max Adler and Otto Bauer, a thrust to which we shall come back in the Germany of the 1920s with Toller and other equally Jewish intellectuals. A thrust a Jewish reader come back in this way. Now why? Why? Especially young Jews put up a utopia, if you like, a socialism, and there are many other examples, Ernst Bloch's utopia, all of them. Why was this such a Jewish affair? Why did the Jews, as one of their great contributions to socialism, no doubt about that, put up a socialism which repudiated dictatorship, which repudiated Lenin, which repudiated Orthodox socialism, and which instead put up a utopia of self-government, a utopia of ethics rather than class struggle, the kind of utopia, as you know, to which the present German student movement wants to go back. That is to say, a utopia which puts forward a democratic socialist revolution without denying the revolution. And I might say here something to which I shall come later, that even when young Jews again sparked their Hegelian revival in Marxism in the 20s, like Lukács, for example, they still kept this ethical ideal, at least at first, in the forefront, as did, of course, Rosa Luxemburg. There is, therefore, among the Jewish group a kind of unity, though they themselves would have repudiated this and denied it very strongly, of course. Eisner, who was aware of this, said that Hermann Cohen combined socialism with the spirit of the prophet. And to be sure, some of the ethical monotheism may be there, but it is not really a good enough explanation. For after all, these young Jews, that generation of young Jews, had really no connection anymore with Judaism. They had not grown to Sunday school, or whatever it's called. They had not grown to that at all. Their parents were emancipated Jews. In their house, there had been nothing that you would call Jewish. So that we must reject very sharply the ideas which are racist ideas, that somehow the spirit of the prophet works in Jews. I always wonder how most of us, at any rate of my generation, had no connection at all with Judaism. And therefore, if we have a social conscience, some of us, I'm sure it doesn't come from the spirit of the prophet. I haven't read the prophet for years and years. So, that we must say that, and that is, of course, nonsense. Otherwise, you come to a racial explanation that somehow the spirit of social justice is a matter of the Jewish blood and the Jewish race. What then can be the explanation? And it is indeed very tricky, and I'm not sure that I have a good explanation for this at all. And perhaps racism is not as mistaken, though I myself am afraid as a long anti-racist and not willing to accept it. We can say some things about it, which I think are true, but they may not be the total explanation for this Jewish socialism. It is a reflection, no doubt, of the feeling of powerlessness, of intellect. After all, the rejection of power and force, to do it differently, by education, by example, through the categorical imperative, well, that gives intellectuals a leadership. And we shall soon see how these people believe they were leaders. They call themselves the conscience of socialism. They try to found special intellectual organizations, special intellectual Soviet, which they believe should be about the Soviet of soldiers and workers, because the intellectuals are in the custodianship of the conscience, of the ethics, of the goal, of the utopia. No doubt about it, that here was an alternative road to a certain on the part of intellectuals who had, after all, no power of their own. This is, I think, quite clear. Second of all, we can say, of course, that this goes into the suspicion of leadership role. Leadership role they weren't going to get in anywhere. As you know from the Madison municipal election a couple of weeks ago, something which you should have learned long ago, workers don't work, vote for workers. Workers voted for Bismarck, but they don't vote for workers. And those who came from working class origins in socialism had a terrible time. Workers fought for smooth talkers. Therefore, the intellectuals might have had a chance. But in reality, they were too far removed from active politics, which they repudiated. After all, no tactics man is the end, never the means. So that they could not, by their very ideology, slip into leadership roles, which as smooth talkers, they might very well have had in socialism. But because of their theory, they could not be leaders. So how do you get around that, if you want to be cynical? You get around that by putting your faith in education, in the self-education. And there you can be a leader. You are the custodian. For Jews, there was a third idea. For how can a Jew link himself to the working class? A serious problem. To come back to it now and then. To the working classes in which anti-Semitism had made considerable inroads, to which the Jews from the suburbs came as a foreigner. Not easy at all. Nevertheless, here again, you have a way in which with this could be done now. Jew or not Jew did not matter. It was a matter of a common experience of governing our own destiny together. Leadership did not matter, origin did not matter. All that mattered was ethical standards on which the intellectuals, Jews or not, mostly Jews in practice, were the custodians. Now what I said up to now, I don't want to sound unduly cynical, for as I say, there is no explanation of this Jewish socialism which has ever satisfied me. There may not be one. One thing you must have learned by now is that there are insoluble problems. This is another insoluble problem, at least in the present state of research. However that might be, one thing is quite clear, that there was such a Jewish element in socialism, that this is a Jewish affair. This you can see simply by statistics. It's not different. That the Jews were the ones who introduced this Kantianism into socialism. That it became for a new generation of Jews a new Jewish religion, as I like to call it. A great alternative to nationalism and Zionism. The alternative, and a very seducing alternative to these kinds of nationalism. Obviously, that is true. But the equation between Jew and the people who elaborated this healthy ideology is too close. It's too close as to avoid the question, which I haven't been able to answer very satisfactorily. Why these young Jews? Why these young Jews? There is, I'm afraid, for them, very little answer. For the young Gentiles who had the same kind of revolution, these young Gentiles did not go this way. We shall come back to it. But it is Jews, always Jews. From this time on, through Marcuse, it is Jews, and again Jews, and that needs an answer and an analysis which has not yet really been given. It is true, isn't it? In fact, in Central Europe, as we shall see, in Central Europe, left-wing intellectual and Jew were synonymous, and this whole business of socialism was just an inter-Jewish discussion. Therefore, it was of no interest in the nation, obviously, in the Jewish discussion. Marcuse. The question is not of interest, but, and I must say that now, in France and in England, this ideal of socialism, this what we can call Kantian socialism, did become a Gentile affair. And therefore, in France and in England, it was to be vastly more influential within the nation than in Central Europe, where it was and it remained an inter-Jewish affair until it was revised in America in the 1960s, first by Jews, but then less by Jews.
and became also glad he brought us there. I'm not so sure about that statement. It would not be wrong to say, therefore, that this type of idealistic socialism, oh, I must say that in Germany that is quite changed, because the German student movement is taking this up. This is their idea. And so, in fact, it will have a great future as the idea of the German student movement is present. It is its idea. So there it did make a breakthrough to a greater reality, I think. It is not wrong to say, therefore, that this type of idealistic socialism became for many Jews both a transcendence of their origin and a kind of humanism which exalted a Jewism with humanity. And they did not realize that what they were into was really, again, a Jewish affair. There's an interesting letter from Rosa Luxemburg, written from prison, to a woman who had asked her about terrible suffering of the Polish Jews. And Rosa Luxemburg writes as follows: "I am not interested in Jews. Leave me alone with your Jewish heart. I do not have a Jewish heart. I am interested in the suffering of all humanity." This was the kind of fusion that you had. This is the kind of fusion. Or again, I'll give you one more example because it will be so important. In Graz, by a very able young Jew, by Rubina, written at the end of the war, called The Powerless. The drama is called The Powerless. And the idea is that the powerless will win. Actually, Rubina's drama is quite topical. For Rubina, out of this kind of ethical socialism, makes a statement, pulls it to its fullest extent, and asks this question in the war: what would it matter if an enemy occupied us? The thing is to avoid war. What does it really matter if we're occupied? For eventually, if we have the right ideas, the enemy will be corrupted by our ideas and ideals, and not by the use of force. So let him come and occupy us, he will strangle us at it. It's not quite the same thing as what Boumediene said to Nasser very shrewdly: let the Israelis occupy Cairo and they will die, which would of course have been quite true. It's not that he means, but rather he means let them occupy us because our ideas will corrupt the enemy. All of this, therefore, is not uninteresting for us as well. If we surrender completely to the enemy, writes Rubina, then nothing remains for which he can thirst. He wants our life. We sacrifice it. He cannot ask for more. He is now isolated, and nothing remains for him but to become as we are. You can murder, but you cannot exterminate what is human. The people will renew themselves. That gives you some more of an idea of all of this kind of a thing. From it, these socialists drew the conclusion that the intellectuals did indeed stand above all class. As Max Adler put it in Austria, if the workers' movement is merely class interest, then it is only a matter of the knife and fork, of the politics of interest, of the imitation of the bourgeoisie. But the idea must be kept alive, and this is the role of the intellectual. For them, the old world is only a sweater which they can take off easily enough. Socialism must be a cultural move, or it is nothing. That is the revolution. The revolution is an ethical deed, and therefore it must be a deed without violence, without force, and without leadership. A deed by the workers themselves. Rosa Luxemburg, as some of you know, fits in this tradition. Now for St.
sensitive Jews then, at the turn of the century, this became a meaningful alternative, both to liberalism and all kinds of nationalism, German nationalism or Zionist nationalism. It will remain. But finally, with it, we have to make two more statements. First of all, these ideals, this new socialism, which began in the 1880s, will continue with added strength. We shall come back to it after 1819, after 1918, when it will be of the greatest strength and of the greatest importance. You yourself, many of you, embrace it, I know. Secondly, I'm not saying that this is a wonderful thing to embrace. I'm not saying in any cynical spirit whatsoever. I think when history is written, this may be the greatest contribution of the Jews to history. You ever thought of that? To put some alternative, peaceful idea of revolution. It may be well the greatest contribution of the Jews to history. And indeed, the greatest Jewish contribution may be that made by Kurt Eisner, and not by some others I can think of. Now, that is of course a personal statement. These people whom you can call, if you like, socialists of the heart, they've been called that and other things then, were a problem. In the end, they were once more homeless Jews. For by the 1920s, all political parties of the left had expelled them. Of course, how could they bend to tactics, political compromise, parliamentary government, all of this? They fell, in other words, in the end, between two chairs, the chair of social democracy and the chair of Leninism, both of which they, after all, are repudiated. So that in the end, they were homeless, and we shall analyze eventually what their homelessness meant, because in the end, as I say, what now begins will go strengthened after the war. We have therefore now, to sum up, seen two alternatives. The nationalist alternative, becoming a better German, French, and the socialist alternative. In the socialist alternative, there lies then a peculiar and important new Jewish contribution. Why is it Jewish? I don't know. We must now come, therefore, to the third alternative. And the third alternative is Zionism. Now, as we come to Zionism, and so they regarded it, As we come to Zionism, we must be clear about one thing. For many of these Jews in the West, it became an alternative only after Herzl. That is to say, as we now come to Zionism, we must realize something of the greatest importance from the very beginning. Namely, that Zionism became an alternative, and it did become an alternative, only subsequently to its beginning. For its beginning was quite different than that associated with socialism and indeed with the nationalism that some embraced. For Zionism was at its beginning a product of liberalism. And indeed, in the West, and with Theodor Herzl, tended to reaffirm liberalism with the ideal of a Jewish state. But there is no doubt, and we shall come, I'll prove in a minute, that for Herzl and for Nordau, the two great charismatic early leaders, the Jewish state was the liberal state. Indeed, if you want to be strictly historical about it, you can say this, that for Herzl and Nordau, the Jewish state was a liberal opportunity, which no longer existed. in Europe itself. If you want to be unkind about it, you can say that just as, let us say, for Rudyard Kipling, the British Empire was the last outpost for the British schoolboy when he could do nothing more in Europe, the Jewish state was the last outpost of liberalism. Let us look, therefore, first at this document itself, at Herzl's Jewish State of 1896, and then we shall have to see its repudiation, for only out of its repudiation this diamond has become an alternative, in the same way as socialism and the other nationalism became for the younger generation. Let us look at it then, and I wish you would now start to read it in Herzberg. Herzl, like Freud, was uprooted from the situation in Vienna, which I have talked to you about before. He began to write the feuilleton. That is to say, he began to write and to engage in a very particular kind of journalism, the journalism of criticism, of cultural criticism, which every European paper still had. No longer today, but then had a column of culture criticism. But this culture criticism, indeed, was really a kind of narcissism. And Herzl, indeed, defined his activity in those days as a kind of narcissism, as a narcissism in an increasingly impossible and uprooted situation. Herzl has been, after all, a member of a nationalist fraternity. He had found that this didn't work. After all, there was the mass movement of the right, the mass movement of Lueger, and Herzl retreated, as so many did, into this kind of journalism, this narcissism, which he describes as follows: falling in love with his own spirit, and thus losing any standard of judgment of himself or others. This subjectivity is a heightened kind of individualism. What he wrote were vignettes. The pride, the emphasis in the feuilleton was on cleverness, on vignettes, on cleverness, on this kind of narcissism. A sign, one more sign, of the uprootedness of this kind of middle class in Vienna. And it is on top of this kind of narcissism, this kind of uprootedness, that he suffered the shock of the Dreyfus affair. But why was it a shock? It was a shock because it was in France. As I have told you again and again, the shock of Dreyfus was that it happened in the nation of the revolution, that it happened in the nation of the Enlightenment. Very doubtful whether Herzl would have been so shocked if it had happened in Germany or in Austria. He was used to anti-Semitism in Germany and Austria, but this was France, the Belle France, the France, the first country that had emancipated the Jews. They forgot how reluctantly that had emancipated the Jews. That was the shock for Herzl. And so he began to consider the Jewish situation. But together with the Jewish situation, he considered, as a matter of fact, the liberal situation. Because the Jewish situation was an outgrowth. He thought rightly of the dissolution of liberalism and of the Enlightenment. The Jewish state was for him not a matter of a new nationalism. That came from Eastern Europe. The Jewish state was for him from the beginning, partly charity. As you will see, Herzberg is quite as honest in his translation of the Jewish state. Point that out in a minute. It's partly charity, but mostly a liberal state, a realization which Herzl, as a man of the world, not a man of the world, these weren't little provincials, these were men of the world. This man of the world knew perfectly well that liberalism and Jewish emancipation were the same. And they built their hopes upon this. The objective reality was perhaps an important, not a spiritual impulse. Read what he has to say about rabbis, didn't like them, thought they could be made useful. Why, they were useless. On the whole, they were useless. There was nothing in Herzl about religion, a spiritual impulse. These were liberals, great journalists of their day. Let me remind you that their friends believed that their Zionism was an aberration. Not on Herzl's friends said, well, these are fabulous journalists, but they're also a little, you know, meshuggah on the side. In other words, their Zionism was to their friends what, let us say, your interest in astrology would be, or whatever little side interest some of you have. Let's keep it in perspective. And I'm saying this because they moved in a quite different world than the world of Eastern Europe. They never understood the world of Eastern Europe. How could they? How could they, really? They lived in a totally different world, really. In fact, then, the first thing that we must know about the Jewish state is that it applied to anti-Semitism. It doesn't arise out of some deep spiritual or national impulse. Herzl despised the new nationalism. He despised spiritualism. His knowledge of Judaism was about, well, I don't want to single any one of you out, but let me tell you, it was hardly existing. And for now, it didn't exist at all, and he didn't care about it either. So, really, it came out of a quite different impulse. It was really, the funny thing, you know, about Herzl is that the founder of Zionism and the Jewish state is really the last gasp of an old system rather than the new. It's the last gasp of liberalism and the Jews rather than what was really to come in much of the Zionist movement. Let us look at the document itself for a minute there. The Jewish question, he tells us, is a piece of medievalism carried into modern times. And who carries this piece of medievalism into modern times? It is carried by the poor Jews. Now, here we come to a very nice history falsification by Mr. Hertzberg. On page 2829, he translates poor Jews with unfortunate Jews. Why, can you guess? Because Herzl is attacking the East European Jews. But this, of course, for a modern Zionist, horrible founder. So Herzberg translates poor as unfortunate and not as poor. And he will omit from your translation the whole section of the Jewish state devoted to the praise of free enterprise. You won't find that in your translation either, by the way. So, what Herzl is really telling us, unlike your translations, is indeed that it is the poor Jews who are the problem, who are carrying the medievalism into modern times. As he puts it, the Jewish question exists. We can no longer ignore it. It is a piece of postponed Middle Ages. And we see it that it cannot be solved by the poor Jews who carry anti-Semitism to England, who have brought anti-Semitism to America. Those aren't the unfortunate Jews. Those are the Eastern European Jews, obviously, he's talking about. Who brought anti-Semitism to England and have brought it to America. Moreover, these Jews have no power. And therefore, the problem cannot be solved in Europe. Herzl implies very strongly that if these Jews had any political power, then perhaps the matter could be solved. But they have no political power. Therefore, that problem can in fact not be solved. Now, what I want to point out about this, I think, is pretty obvious. For Herzl, Zionism is, first of all, a question of the East European Jews. He looks at it from the outside. Oh, he says we are one people. But he immediately turns around and talks in a very abstracted way about these poor Jews who carry anti-Semitism everywhere. Presumably Herzl did. But the poor Jews who carry anti-Semitism everywhere. And second of all, Zionism is for him a problem of political power. It isn't a problem of some biblical revival. It isn't a problem of some spiritual impulse. It's a problem of power. What do you do? Here you have a problem. They have no power. What is the solution? The solution is only a state of their own. For Herzl's construction is not devoid of the ideal of charity. Here I want you to look at Herzberg, page 221. Herzberg, page 221. For how is it actually to be built, this new state? It's to be built as follows. As follows. First, the poor will go, and they will work to make the land fertile. They will build streets and bridges and railways and telegraphs and regulate rivers and build houses. Their work will bring traffic and transport and markets. After this work only will come the rich. Now, in a sense, this is of course totally realistic. But in another sense, it is an odd kind of construction. The heavy work will be done by the poor, and the rich will come with their capital and really, in a sense, take advantage of it. What this is again a liberal construct. It was not Herzl's intention to change property relations. And as a matter of fact, for the spiritual impulse, please look at Herzberg 222, where he says that Argentina might do as well as Palestine. No. And why then Palestine? Why Palestine? Because Palestine, he tells us, is a marvelous rallying cry. In other words, again, if you like, a political judgment. You can't really do it without Palestine. Not because of any mystique, but it's a good rallying cry. The poor masses of Eastern Europe, that's a way you can get them over there. But you couldn't get them to Argentina or without it. With Zionism, I will continue.